You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.
Welcome to The Infinite Consciousness this week, and thanks for listening. Tonight we have with us a quite unique scientist. We've not had anybody like him before, so I anticipate this to be a really great show. It's Dr. Bernard Haish, and we're going to talk about his book, The God Theory. How are you, Bernard?
Oh, doing just fine tonight. How are you?
Good, thanks. Thanks for coming on tonight. You have a really fabulous book.
Well, thank you.
Tell us a little, before we get started, why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are, where people can find your information, and a little bit about your background.
Right. Well, the way to find the information is to go to thegodtheory.com. It's thegodtheory.com. That's the website for the book, and the book itself is available at most bookstores. Amazon, Borders carries it, The God Theory. My own background is in astronomy and astrophysics. I have a PhD from the University of Wisconsin. I've worked primarily on NASA projects for most of my career. I've published lots of scientific papers. I was one of the editors of the Astrophysical Journal, which is the leading journal in that field. But simultaneously, I was also editor of the Journal of Scientific Exploration, which publishes papers on topics that are sort of outside the mainstream of science. So I kept my foot, or kept one foot in each world for quite some time doing the editing of both of these journals, one being a very mainstream scientific journal, and the other one being a journal that really was dedicated to trying to open up the field of science to some of the more, to some of the anomalies at the fringes.
Mm-hmm. Now go ahead.
I was going to say that my background, going back a little further, goes to the time when I was in a seminary, when I was 18, 19 years old, trained to be a Catholic priest. So that, I think, is the reason that some of these spiritual considerations have stuck with me and why I wrote The God Theory. My background is a former seminarian in my teen years, and then my background in astrophysics for my professional career.
That was what I was about to ask you. Most people that, like Bill Tiller and, you know, Dean Radin, some of those people, most people that get off into this fringe work, into consciousness, have had some kind of epiphany in their life. Did you have an epiphany period?
Well, I can't really say that I did. I had this interest in spirituality and religion and becoming a priest someday since I was a little boy, and I followed that through my high school years and on into college. But then I really did leave that behind to pursue a career in astrophysics. But I guess the basic questions about whether or not there is a God, what the purpose of my life is, what my own nature is, those questions never left me. And so I just felt sort of more and more motivated over the years to try to put my best thoughts down on paper. And it was a long process, but ultimately the God theory was what came about.
Well, to start off with, I've been interviewing who I consider to be the major luminaries in the world, and on the topic of consciousness. And what I found is I posed about 20 questions to each one of them. The first one, what is consciousness? And I found that I've gotten answers all over the board, and that people are having conversations about this word and not having a meeting of the minds even, and not even realizing that they're not having a meeting of the minds about what they're talking about. So what is consciousness to you?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask me that question outright. Well, I know, it's a difficult topic.
Yeah, it is.
My basic hypothesis is that consciousness is the primary stuff of the universe, that there is an intelligence behind the origin of our universe, and this intelligence is conscious. And it's that consciousness that is the basis of everything, our universe, perhaps other universes that may exist. And our own consciousness is just a bit of that, that it's like a giant bonfire of consciousness, and we're little flames, little sparks, little candles that have that same consciousness, but of course in a much more limited way, because we live in physical bodies in a physical universe, and so our consciousness is necessarily limited. But I think it's the same as the supreme consciousness that some intelligence has that is the basis for our universe.
So you would agree that there are gradients in conscious awareness?
Oh, I would say so, yeah, among people. And certainly if you go down into the animal kingdom, I mean, animals, I think, are conscious, but their consciousness must be one of a lesser sort than ours, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that in human beings, there's definitely gradients of conscious awareness, because you can talk to a fundamental Christian about this, and it's like talking to a telephone pole. They have no idea what you're talking about and can't grasp it. So, you know, only reasoning I can get out of that is that there must be some kind of gradient in our conscious awareness. I just don't know why. Do you have any idea why that would be?
Well, I think a lot has to do with our upbringing. We tend to believe the things that we're surrounded by. We see this in science. You know, scientists are generally pretty smart people, if you don't mind my saying so, but they have a worldview. And that worldview is governed by what they've experienced, by their teachers, by the work that they've done, by the colleagues in the field. And so you acquire a certain perspective on the world, and that's hard to change. Even if you're a very bright and inquisitive person, you might have a consciousness that could be rather restricted by the background you bring to it. So I think some of it has to do with the environment and the culture and the upbringing that you have.
What about, and I'm going to use this word, excuse me, frequencies, because I don't know what other word to use, maybe resonance or some kind of harmonics. I know there's a problem with that word, frequency, but when I say that word, I mean some kind of quivering that delivers some kind of encoded message, you know, in the field. I don't know where it comes from, but where would you say that the original intention would come from, and how would it be conveyed into the human being or the dog or whatever it is?
By original intention, you mean the origin of consciousness or what?
I'm leaving that up to you.
Okay.
That's what I mean, but some people take it to mean something else. I'm just giving you free roll here.
Well, my basic concept in the book is that we are incarnations of God. So this leads into the discussion of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
If we have an intelligence, it's my hypothesis that intelligence has infinite potential, can do anything. But potential is one thing and experience is something else. And so what I think the motivation is for creating a universe, for having beings living in that universe, arising, by the way, by natural selection, in my opinion, the point of that is to transform sterile potential into real experience. And that's what I think we're doing. I think we are little incarnations of God experiencing all the various different interesting, exciting, terrible things that can happen in the physical life and the physical universe. And the origin of our consciousness is that it is the same consciousness as the Creator. We have a little bit of it. Each one of us does.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that's where I think it comes from and why it comes from there.
How do you think it's conveyed?
I guess I don't know what you mean by conveyed. I guess I see us as human beings when we are born, or when we come into this world, rather, that our consciousness is part of that physical body that we bring along, that attached to our physical body or associated with it is a motivating consciousness, the thing that makes us alive. I think it's the consciousness that makes us be alive as opposed to being a rock or a stone.
I guess what I mean is, let me back up just a little bit. Do you look at consciousness as being a field? What do you see it as being?
I really don't know. Consciousness is something that I experience, as does everybody, and so I think I know it in that intimate sense of what it feels like internally.
Mm-hmm.
But what it might be externally, I really haven't any idea.
Do you think that we live in a holographic environment?
Again, I've heard that term bandied about in the context of explaining our universe, but I really don't know what it means. I mean, I know what a hologram is in terms of physics, and how it can be used to project three-dimensional images and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But what it means in terms of consciousness in the universe, I truly don't know.
Okay. Tell me your position on mass. Do you think that mass really exists on the quantum level?
That mass, is that the question?
I'm sorry, mass.
Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of interesting because that takes me off into the tangent of some research that I've done for NASA back when I was working at Lockheed Martin in the late 90s. In fact, research that continues to this day. The question of what causes mass is a profound one in physics, and physicists have spent decades now looking for something called a Higgs particle, which constitutes the Higgs field, which is where mass is supposed to come from. In my opinion, mass can be traced back to something very familiar in physics, but rather different, which is the quantum vacuum, sometimes known as a zero-point field.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And my colleagues and I published a number of papers on this beginning in about 1994, and we haven't been totally successful in showing mathematically that this is absolutely correct. It's a good a good start at showing how there may be this alternate view to seeing where mass comes from. And I talk about this in the book somewhat. The idea being that there's an underlying sea of quantum light called the zero-point field,
mm-hmm.
and this can very specifically be connected to the mass-like properties of matter. So it may be that the zero-point field is the basis of mass. That's what I tend to think is correct.
Now, assume, you know, I don't have the vocabulary that you have, and I'm going to assume that the majority of my listeners, though, I understand consciousness quite a bit, but I don't have the vocabulary to say everything I want. So assume that we don't know everything that you're talking about. When you say that it's from the zero-point field, is that the dividing line, do you think, of duality?
I wouldn't know how to answer that because I don't know in what sense you're using duality. The zero-point field is defined in a very specific way in physics. It has to do with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle as it's applied to light and other
radiation. And tell us what that is in layman's terms, because a lot of people are not going to know what that means to us. What does that mean to us?
The Heisenberg uncertainty principle is one of the bases of quantum mechanics. Now, in the ordinary world, everything, if you say push on a car, eventually, and you stop pushing, eventually the car will come to rest. Everything comes to rest because of friction in the ordinary world. But in the quantum world, it's very different. There is a rule in quantum physics that says that you can never take out the last little bit of energy from anything. And so if you can imagine a little pendulum swinging back and forth, in the real world, that pendulum will eventually come to rest because of friction. But in the quantum world, that pendulum will keep moving back and forth, sort of fluctuating at random forever, because there are quantum laws at work that say that you can't ever remove all the last little bit of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the law that's embodied in the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Okay. Now, I asked Bill Tiller this question one time if he thought that the zero-point field was the source of all there is, maybe. And he said, well, you know, the zero-point field is just where it's 0 degrees. Centigrade, I think is what he said. Am I right there?
No, 0 degrees Kelvin, minus
37. Okay, Kelvin.
Yeah.
And he said, I believe that consciousness, the source of consciousness resides deep down into the zero field, so the zero-point field. So do you think that it's right there at that line of that particular temperature, or does it take all of the vacuum into consideration?
Well, no, I really don't think that one can make that glib an association between the zero-point field and consciousness. The zero-point field in physics is a very rigidly defined, very strictly delimited thing. It's a very physical kind of quantity. It's rigorously defined. It has nothing whatsoever to do with consciousness in physics. And that's the zero-point field I'm talking about, because that's the one that I know. That's the one that we know how to deal with mathematically.
Mm-hmm.
And the extrapolations of that to consciousness is a huge, huge leap. And one that I'm not prepared to make.
Okay, how would the zero-point field contribute to making mass? What would happen?
Well, as it turns out, if you look at how fundamental particles, everything in nature is comprised of atoms, and atoms are composed of electrons and protons are composed of quarks and so on. So, if you look at the most fundamental particles that we know that exist that make up you and me and the whole physical world, the electrons and the quarks. What we found in the investigations we did, funded by NASA, and by we I mean myself and Alfonso Rueda and some other collaborators that we worked with on and off, we found that the effect of this zero-point field when interacting with matter that's forced to accelerate gave us exactly the right properties to account for inertia. And so it looks as if mass is something that's not intrinsic to matter, but rather mass is sort of a resistance that comes about when anything has to move through the zero-point field in an accelerated fashion.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we showed mathematically in a series of papers that we published.
What would you, where would you think the source of the intention or the source of creativity, how would it dictate what's created?
Well, I think that, that's a good question because I think that the point of the universe is for God to experience some of his potential through the actualization of that potential in a universe with laws and in a universe with life forms that arise in it. And so I think the intention is for a universe to have laws and to let those laws then sort of have free reign to see what can evolve from them. What can happen in the universe with this set of laws? Well, stars can form, planets can form, life forms can originate on those planets, life forms can evolve. So I think that the point is that consciousness wanted to create kind of a playground, a school, a workshop where new and novel things can happen, and that then actualizes the potential that lies behind the whole creation.
All right. Now, earlier I'd asked you a question about how do you think that intention is conveyed into the mass. So what I kind of mean here is I kind of think that when you think of thought, that some kind of electromagnetic signal is sent out, and it may be sent out in a fashion similar to the Morse code, but that some kind of frequency or resonance, and that that certain set of signals mean something, and it causes certain atoms to start, you know, bumping into each other and shaping and forming. Does that make sense?
Well, I got to say, I don't understand it, no.
Okay. Well, how do you think the intention creates the mass? How does the signaling go out from the intention? Say to us, how do we receive the intention from the source in our brain? How does it get there?
Mm.
How does it convey it? Do you have any idea about that?
Not a great deal. I mean, I think we've got to be careful in trying to separate the consciousness from our brain. I think our brain is a transducer of information. I think.
Yes, I do too. But how does it receive the information? I mean, we know that it's kind of like a radio signal, but do you think that it has encoded signalings in it
The first thing that comes to mind about where information comes from is through our senses. I mean, our senses provide our brain with input, and our brain, I think, then communicates with our consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where can information come in not through the senses? I think so. But at that point, I've got to say, well, I think there's evidence that that happens, but I don't really have the faintest idea what the mechanism is for doing that.
Okay. You talk in your book that you think that creation simply is. What do you mean by that?
That creation simply is.
You said you were talking about that the universes have always existed, and so you said that creation simply is.
No, I don't think you ever said the universe always existed, because the universe as we know it in astrophysics is 13.7 billion years old. We know
you were discussing that, and then you were talking about rather than it existed, that it simply, than being created, that it actually just was.
Well, I think what you're alluding to is my discussion of the nature of space and time.
Yes.
Our universe is 13.7 billion years old. We know that through various channels in astrophysics very solidly. Now the question is there a time before that? Or is time something that came just along with the universe, just the way
mm-hmm.
physical laws came with the universe, did time come with the universe? In my view, is that space and time are part of this universe, but are not part of the whatever grander realm there is within which the conscious seat of everything has created us. And so I think that space and time are things that are just part of this universe, and that the consciousness that's beyond that does not experience space and time.
Do you think it was the universe was like a void that was just bubbling with energy potential before the universe was created?
Well, I think it became an energy potential when an intelligence willed it to be that. I think it was not just that of its own accord. I think that there's an intelligence who willed the dynamic energy and particles and laws of nature into existence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's those divine ideas, I shouldn't say divine, I suppose, but those intelligent ideas that form the basis for the physical universe.
Do you think that it was, I can't think of a word here. I mean, everything didn't just appear at one time, do you think? Do you think that it evolved over millions and billions of years?
Well, something did appear sort of at once, and that was the universe at its origin, at the Big Bang.
Mm-hmm.
That happened at a very definite point, tracing backwards in time as we know it. But then, of course, lots of things happened in those intervening 13.7 billion years. We had stars forming and galaxies forming and planets, and we had life evolving on at least one planet and probably on billions. Mm-hmm. So lots of things happened after that. But it did begin at a specific point. It did begin at a specific point of origin.
And do you have any idea of what caused that specific point of origin to occur?
Yeah, I think personally it was the will of an intelligence who wanted to have mm-hmm. a universe in which experience could take place. And therefore, this universe was willed into existence. And then it was set off to run on its own. So I want to differentiate what I'm saying about an intelligence behind the universe from intelligent design, because that's not at all what I'm talking about. I'm not at all saying that there is any kind of microengineering of life forms by God or by any other intelligence. I think that the laws of nature were the things that were thought into existence. But once thought mm-hmm. into existence, those laws of nature had a life of their own. And that's the whole point, for novelty and uniqueness and something brand new to originate spontaneously so that the intelligence behind it all can experience what its potential, her potential, mm-hmm. its potential, can lead to.
I agree with you. Do you think that this intelligence has emotion? Because we know that in the physical body that emotion is created by a chemical combination. So do you think that the intelligent views everything as simply being perfect as opposed to having emotion attached to it?
Well, you know, maybe this particular universe was created in order for emotion to come about. I mean, I think that we're back to the issue of potential versus experience. Emotion mm-hmm. is a very experiential thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe this intelligence did not actually have any emotion in its pristine absolute state,
mm-hmm.
but can experience emotion through us, because it's
exactly.
in the physical realm that emotion has a free rein to take place.
Exactly. I agree with you on that. Because it doesn't make, if it had emotion, then it would have judgment attached to it, and it wouldn't make any sense for painful things or things that we could interpret as painful things to occur if it had emotion, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think causes the zero-point field to fluctuate? Is it intention from the original source, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think it's there's certainly just a minimum amount of energy that's associated with any given thing. And when you look specifically at light, at the minimum amount of energy that there can be in any little beam of light, by that I mean any given frequency of light, direction of light, that minimum amount of energy has a specific value that's specified by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that we discussed before. And when you look at the nature of light, you see that these fluctuations that are called the zero-point field fluctuations have a very specific value that's related to the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and so that's where it comes from. There's a basic threshold in the universe of uncertainty, and it's that threshold of uncertainty that translates into the zero-point field.
So, do you think that the zero-point field gives off light?
Well, it is light. It is light of a sort.
Can you explain that? Because I found that very interesting in your book. None of the people that I've interviewed have brought that up. That's why I asked if you thought it was a dividing line between duality, you know, the void and the vacuum and all of the energy potential, and then the other side that has the light, the mass, the stars, the suns, you know, the light.
The zero-point field is a form of light, but it's a peculiar kind of light in that it's light that comes and goes so quickly that you can't really see it, but the aggregate amount of energy that's there is tremendous. I mean, it's enormous. It's huge. It makes the energy of the sun seem like nothing. But it's a kind of light that pops in and out of existence so rapidly that we can't directly experience it. And yet, I think that it's probably the basis for mass in the universe. It's the thing that gives matter the property of mass. And the property of mass is what creates a stable universe. And so I think
mm-hmm.
it's extremely important, and it's extremely powerful, but it's also extremely invisible.
And I know we've talked about this a few minutes ago, but I don't think I've really grasped it. And I want to grasp it. It's important to me. Can you give me some more insight about how the zero-point field helps create mass? Because I haven't really been able to grasp that yet.
It's a tough one to grasp because the mathematics that we went through was extremely complicated. We published this in top-notch physics journals, and believe me, the math behind it was pretty intense.
And do it in layman's terms so that people like me can understand.
I'm trying. It's not an easy concept.
I know it.
What we did in the first paper was we took an idealized particle of matter and said, let's let this particle oscillate back and forth as if it were a pendulum. So that was a mathematical pendulum is what we created mathematically. And we said, well, let this mathematical pendulum accelerate through the zero-point field. Does anything happen? And as it turns out, the laws of electromagnetism did make something happen. I'm talking about happen in terms of analysis or mathematical analysis.
Mm-hmm.
The laws of electrodynamics exerted a force on that little idealized oscillator, and that force was directly proportional to the acceleration. And that was the key finding because that shows, in my opinion, that what we were finding was that the basis of mass, the thing that gives inertia to matter, is really the zero-point field. It's like a molasses through which things are pushed, and when you push through molasses, you get resistance. And it's the zero-point field that gave resistance to matter upon acceleration. So that was our key finding.
So would that mean that it would cause atoms to start bumping and knocking and sticking together and creating things?
Well, in a sense. I mean, it gives atoms the property of mass. And mass conveys stability, and with stability you have the possibility of chemistry, and with chemistry you have the possibility of structures forming, and,
okay.
and plants and minerals and animals and us.
Okay. Let's move into the physical reality for just a minute. Do you think that thought from human beings, for example, creates mass or matter?
Well, I think that... the idea that we are, well, first of all, the idea that consciousness is primary is an important one.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think, and this is contrary to virtually all mainstream scientists, I tend to think that consciousness will not be understood as something that emerges from our brain, but rather that somehow consciousness is primary.
I totally agree with you.
That raises the question, though, if consciousness is primary and consciousness is a creative thing, then how come I can't just sit here at my desk and will into existence something, like maybe, for example, a stack of $100 bills on my desk.
Right, right.
Well, we would live in a very, very chaotic world if we could all manifest the things that we're wishing for, because some of those things would be very destructive.
Mm-hmm.
We would probably cause harm to each other. So there's got to be a built-in suppressor for any kind of creativity that our consciousness possesses. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to have a world at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, basically, we are creatures of consciousness. And ultimately, we are creative beings. And ultimately... the creativity that this intelligence has that forms the basis of the universe is the same creativity that we have, but of course ours is reined in to a much greater degree.
Mm-hmm. So, but I don't feel like we really answered that question. I mean, we know through the work of Bob John, at Princeton, and through Bill Tiller's work and Dean Radin's work, that something happens. I mean, when we think thoughts, we do know that it manipulates matter to some small degree.
That's right,
to
some small degree. I think that the experiments at Princeton, and in fact I know Bob John and Brenda Dunn very well, I've known them for decades now, I respect their work a great deal, and I think what they've shown is that there is a residual bit of measurable consciousness, a residual bit of measurable conscious influence that they've been able to capture with their experiments on random number generators.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've shown, what this little bit of leftover unsuppressed conscious creativity can do. And I think the problem is now, given the world that we're in, if that power that we have were any larger, it would probably cause chaotic effects for society.
Right.
So it's got to be limited, but it's really great that it's not totally suppressed, that there's enough there that you can actually, in the laboratory, come up with some scientifically plausible measurements, which is what I think they've done at Princeton.
Mm-hmm. Even though conventional science denies that it's real. I can't stand it. Are you familiar with HeartMath's work?
I've met Glenn Ryan, but it's been years since I've had any dealings with the organization.
So I was wondering, do you think that our ability to create or manipulate mass has something to do with the cohesion maybe of our electromagnetic field?
I don't know.
Okay. Let's go back to your book on the zero-point field. And what do you think the role of hydrogen is in building mass?
Well, hydrogen is, of course, the simplest element. So that's the first element that was formed when after the Big Bang happened and cooled down. So the first atoms that were formed were hydrogen atoms, and hydrogen forms the basis of stars, because what stars do is they're great clouds of hydrogen, which mm-hmm. contract, and then thermonuclear reactions start up, and hydrogen is converted into other elements. So hydrogen is extremely important because that's what powers the sun and other stars. And that powering of the sun and other stars, of course, is what provides light and heat and the right conditions for life. And so hydrogen is very important in that regard.
Well, one thing I've always wondered, because it being the simplest element, I've kind of always wondered if that was like the building block of physical reality. And does that get depleted with all of the free radicals and pollution and stuff that's put out? And if we had cleaner fuel that put out hydrogen as a byproduct or something like that, would we have more building blocks for the earth to heal itself?
Not really, because hydrogen is not that important for earth. I mean, it's important in the sun, because that's what powers the sun, and the sun's light is what powers the earth ultimately, whether we use solar energy directly mm-hmm. or whether we're getting fossil fuels, you know, which were also driven by the sun millions of years ago. It's really the hydrogen power in the sun that has given rise to life on Earth. But in terms of its presence here on Earth, it's just it's kind of a trace element among other much more common elements like silicon and carbon and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important, but there's nothing about it that is intrinsically of great necessity for the Earth, other than its role in the sun.
Mm-hmm. What happens when lines of thought meet rather than diverge?
Well, I think it was Heisenberg that said that when they meet rather than diverge, you can get some really interesting new developments, that they can be very synergetic to bring two different lines of thought together. And the problem is now that we're kind of heading in opposite directions, and that's worrisome. We have science on the one hand going off in its reductionist materialist perspectives that say, you know, there's nothing but matter, and that's all there is. There can be no spirituality, no soul, no God, and we've discovered all this. And on the other hand, you have religions that seem to be getting, in many cases, more intolerant, more dogmatic. And instead of having this happy intermingling of two different traditions, you've got things that seem to be growing apart, and it's a dangerous trend, a very dangerous trend.
When you're having the theological background that you have, as well as your scientific background, have you found that your work supports the various religious beliefs as a unity-type belief?
Well, I want to differentiate between religion and spirituality, because I think they're very, very different things. Religions are primarily man-made structures, man-made organizations. Mm-hmm. And as a result, they come along with a huge baggage of problems, ranging from intolerance to the power plays and political struggles that have gone along with the building of churches and the money that comes along with it. So I don't necessarily see religion as a very good thing at all. In fact, you know, recently I found myself reading some of the anti-religion books, the Sam Harris book on Letter to a Christian Nation and the Christopher Hitchens book on God is Not Great. I've been reading these two books, and I've got to say, I agree with a huge amount of stuff that they say, because religion has been very, very bad in many ways. Spirituality is a very different thing.
Yes, it is.
Spirituality is, I think, ultimately a truth, and I think someday we will be studying spirituality alongside astronomy and chemistry and biology as one of the branches of knowledge. I don't think we can ever do without it, because I think basically we are spiritual beings. But I certainly hope someday religion will vanish, because religion has been the source of a huge amount of the
mm-hmm.
world's problems. Not all the world's problems, but a huge amount.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. It's a significant problem. That's one of the reasons the entire world wars all the time. Somebody's religion's wrong and the other person's religion's right. I always say, you know, if there was more than one God, wouldn't the most powerful one stand up and say, I'm the one? You know? You talk some in your book, well, quite a bit, and I don't really understand it. I mean, I understand it kind of in the book, but I don't understand to be able to dialogue on it properly. But you talk about the decay of the atom and mass and physical reality. Tell us what you mean by that and what it means to us.
Well, I'm trying to think of where in the book I talked about the decay of the atom. It may have been with respect to the idea that the zero-point field may be responsible for keeping atoms stable. Now, that's kind of a technical subject. I'm not sure that would actually enhance the discussion here tonight because it's going off in kind of a deep physics discussion. And that's the only thing I can think of in the book that talks about the decay of the atom.
I'm trying to find it here. You were talking about how different kind of elements take different amounts of time to, like, consider now a single atom of fluorine.
Now you're jogging my memory.
Like?
Did I write that? Let me see. Yes. What I was talking about was why do things happen? Now, let's say an atom is a radioactive atom, radium or uranium. And so you know that after a certain amount of time, that atom is going to decay into it's going to fission, say, into two different elements, like uranium does.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know on average how long it's going to take for any atom to do that. It's the half-life of the element. But what is it that tells that atom, look, buddy, time is passing. You got 30 seconds left. Come on, it's time to decay. Come on, 15 seconds. Let's go. Get a move on. How does that atom know that time is passing and that it's time to do something? It's a big, big question. The suggestion was made by Sir William McCrae. He was a very prominent British astrophysicist who won a medal from the Royal Astronomical Society in the 1980s. And he gave a lecture on this, on the zero-point field. And he said he thought that the reason things happen, the thing that's the timekeeper, the thing that jiggles away and sort of tells the atom, look, get moving, it's time to decay or whatever else they have to do, can be traced back to the zero-point fluctuation. That something is driving the clock of the universe. Something is causing things to happen. And he traced it back to the zero-point fluctuations. And I thought that was very profound.
I do, too, but it makes me want to ask this question again. How does the atom get the message?
That's exactly that's the point. The atom is sitting there. Now, does the atom have a clock, a wristwatch on? No, it doesn't have a timer on. The atom is just sitting there, but eventually it's got to do whatever it's supposed to do, such as decay.
Does it do it through... See, I see in my head like horizontal and vertical energy lines that are as close together as the lines on a record album. And I see those lines quivering. And I think that these lines are the things that make up the hologram, say, for example. And I see them quivering, and I see like impulses being sent through those lines of, I don't know what they are, energy lines of some sort. So that's the only way I can think of that an atom could get a message is through some kind of pulsing or signaling.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that it's the fluctuations of the zero-point field, and we know what those fluctuations are like. We know we can characterize
them. Yeah. Well, I think that would send this. That would probably be what the source of that signaling is. It would seem logical to me.
Well, the zero-point field is very random, and so it's a great thing for keeping time because it's perfectly, perfectly random, in a sense, perfectly predictable because it is so random. So it acts as kind of a jostler. It jostles things. And it's exactly, I think, what you need to make things happen. If you take it away, then time simply passes. But who's going to tell an atom or a molecule, hey, time has passed, do something?
Mm-hmm.
It has to be informed in some way that something is happening and it's time to go and do whatever it has to do. And I think it's those zero-point fluctuations that lie at the root of that.
And how have your colleagues accepted that theory? I think it's a very good one, and it makes perfect sense to me. But how have your colleagues accepted it?
Well, it's been difficult. We've gotten our papers published in respectable journals, such as the Physical Review,
mm-hmm.
such as the Nalander Physique, which was the same journal, by the way, that published Einstein's special relativity 100 years ago. It's kind of funny that my colleague and I managed to get one of our zero-point field papers published on sort of on the 100th anniversary of the journal Nalander Physique, 100th anniversary after they published Einstein's paper on special relativity.
Kind of an interesting synchronicity.
But apart from that, we did also get a major NASA grant in the mid-1990s to do zero-point field studies. That was very gratifying. So we had the papers published, we had NASA funding, we had funding from Lockheed Martin. But it's still not the kind of thing that's gotten a whole lot of acceptance. The search is still on, of course, for the Higgs field, the Higgs particle. And when the new
Now tell us what that is.
Well, when the new European Collider comes online next year, people will be looking for something called a Higgs particle. It's you ask what it is, and I can't go into any great detail, first of all, because I don't know the detail that well, and secondly, because nobody really does. It's just a particle that is the conveyor of a field that supposedly provides mass to all the particles that are known to exist. Now, you know, there's some mathematics behind that, but not a great deal. It's just something that you need to provide mass, and I'm suggesting that you don't need that at all. That probably we have right in front of us already and have known for 70 years the existence of something that can provide mass, and that would be the zero-point field, the electromagnetic zero-point field.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, do you have any opinions about synchronicities that occur?
Well, I do tend to take them seriously because I think that I have experienced some. Don't ask me, I can't remember any examples, but I think I have experienced some. My wife experiences them all the time. She's very much more intuitive than I am, a very experiential person.
Mm-hmm.
So I do take them seriously. In fact, so did Wolfgang Pauli. He worked with together with Carl Jung at one point to look into synchronicities. And I think there's a paper they jointly wrote together. So I do think they happen, and they're part of this mysterious way in which I think consciousness interacts with us in the universe.
Do you have any idea how or what makes them occur?
Nope.
All right, let's talk a minute about multiple or parallel universes. Mm-hmm. Do you think that, let's just take our lives right now. Do you think that this life is like a movie and that it's set and it just plays out, or do you think that it has variables in it?
Oh, definitely variables. I mean, I just couldn't imagine if it was like a movie playing out, then basically we would not be having this conversation freely. We would be simply robots acting out a script. We would have no free will. We would not really be intelligent beings at all. We would simply be robots. And I just don't believe that.
Do you think we have complete free will?
I think we have complete free will, yes.
Well, if we have complete free will...
Of course, that free will is conditioned by things. You know, we're limited. I mean, I may have the free will to make $1 million appear in my bank account. But that's not going to happen because I will it. We are constrained by the laws of society and the wishes of other people and all these other things.
Okay. Because I was going to say, if we had complete free will, then you could say, Eva, meet me at Starbucks at 3 o'clock, and we'd both be there exactly 3 o'clock, not 5 minutes before, not 5 minutes after. We wouldn't get lost. We wouldn't get a phone call or whatever.
Well, no. I mean, my free will, in my opinion, is willing to do something. It doesn't mean it's going to happen. I mean, will it. I think I've got the perfect ability to will it, but it doesn't mean I can make it happen.
Okay.
I think they're two different things.
Mm-hmm. What do you believe free will is? Because that's a big debate among people. You know, a lot of people don't really have a complete understanding of what is will.
Well, I think will is just an aspect of our consciousness. If we are conscious beings, then we have the ability to make choices, to wish for things, and I think free will is simply one aspect of being and having consciousness.
All right. And do you think that we exist in more than one reality at a time?
It's hard to say. I think that we come into and out of physical reality. I think that we are basically spiritual beings with an immortal consciousness that's the same as God's.
Mm-hmm.
And we come into this life and other lives to experience what it's like. In between lives, where do we go? I don't know. Some other kind of realm, I suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Does that realm have space and time? Probably not. It's probably very different than the space and time we experience
mm-hmm.
here. But that's about as far as I can go with it because I've never been, well, I may have been there, but I don't remember.
Right. Do you think there are past or future lives, or do you think everything's happening simultaneously?
Depends on your point of view. From within the universe, of course, we are in a time flow. Time flows on, and we're part of that time stream. Now, if you step outside of time, which I think is where the realm of the intelligence behind the universe is outside of time,
mm-hmm.
then from that perspective, there is sort of an all-at-once view of the universe, that
mm-hmm.
the beginning and the end and everything in between is sort of there all at once. But we certainly don't experience that in everyday life here because we are now
right.
in the time stream.
Well, one thing I was wondering, if you stated in your book that the cells of a human body creates a billion times a billion times a billion alternate universes every second. What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, I was talking about a perfectly horrid theory called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. This discussion gets kind of technical, so I'm not sure we want to go down that path. I was writing in the book about why I absolutely don't think that the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics makes any sense. Because in it, every possible choice that you or I could make is acted out. It becomes real in some alternate universe. But that also means that every single splitting of an atom or any event that happens any place in the universe brings about a whole new universe. And so there are a billion times a billion times a billion times a billion times a billion, I can say it several more times, versions of you that are created every second living in different universes. And I think it's insane.
So how would these universes exist? Would it be like in a different, and I'm going to use this word frequency again, but I don't know what other word to use. How would they propose that it exists?
Very good question. I don't know how. The theory makes no sense to me in the first place.
Do you have an opinion about parallel universes? How many of them there are? What are they?
Well, I think it's likely that there are other universes that are parallel in the sense of being in other dimensions. Not parallel in the sense of having us be in them, and that there's a different version of me doing different things and a different version of you doing different things. I don't believe in that. I think it's possible and maybe even likely that there are all sorts of other universes that are separated from ours in other dimensions, because after all, string theory talks about 6, 7 rolled up dimensions in addition to the 4 that we have, or even more than that. So the idea of multiple dimensions beyond the ones that we're aware of in ordinary life, that's very commonplace in physics now.
So if, and then we're going to go back to this word frequency again. Do you know what I mean when I say that word?
Well, I know what frequency
means. What I'm trying to allude to.
I don't think we're using it in the same way. So I guess I'd have to say, no, I don't know how you're using it.
Okay. Well, I envision it as being like those energy lines fluctuating at a certain oscillation rate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how else to describe it, but
well, frequency is that's the right way to characterize oscillations. That's true.
So why couldn't there be, let's just pick some numbers here and say that everything in physical reality, as we know, me and you and our table and chairs, oscillate at a rate, let's say, up to 300,000 hertz, from 0 to 300,000 hertz. Let's just pick a number. And then everything from 3,001 hertz up to 600,000 hertz, it would be things existing in those frequencies or oscillation rates right there, but they would be at such a high rate that they wouldn't be visible to us, but they would still be right here. Why would that not be possible?
Well, why would it be possible is a question to ask, because what is it that's oscillating? If it's the atoms that are moving, then the frequency doesn't matter. The atoms are still the atoms. The question is, what is it that's oscillating? You have to define that first. And I don't know what that is.
Oh, okay. That's a good point. I guess it would be other masses just oscillating at a higher rate.
Yeah. I just don't know what that means.
That's frustrating to me not to be able to get my questions across. I need to go back to school and broaden my vocabulary, I guess. So
it gets tricky.
Do what?
I say it gets tricky.
It does, especially when it comes to consciousness and things like that. So what do you think is the most important piece of work that you've found?
You mean that I've done, that I've found, or where?
Yeah. Well, interpret that however you want to interpret it.
Well, the most important thing I've done for myself, not actually done for myself, but that I have done, I think it's write this book. I think this book is probably more important than all the physics and astronomy papers I've published or the other work that I've done. So for me, this is kind of a pinnacle of my thinking and trying to give the world something that I think is really helpful, something that's really necessary today. So if you don't mind, let me again point your listeners to thegodtheory.com and get the book. You can get it off Amazon. The purpose of my life may have been to write this book, and the purpose of my career may have been to lead to me being in a position to write this book. So that's personally the thing that's probably the most important, unless some of the zero-point field ideas pan out. If they do, that could turn out to be more important, but, who knows.
So what is your main message to the world?
That there's a purpose for your life, and that there's a purpose for the universe, and that God and science can be totally compatible. You don't have to give up anything in terms of God or on the scientific side, to have a purposeful life and to have something that you can believe in.
And are you of the opinion that, I'm of this opinion, and I think you are, that God is not somebody with a beard sitting somewhere?
Definitely not a beard.
But an energy.
Probably not even energy. I mean, God, I think, is As Kabbalah says, God is beyond any attribute that we give it. Whatever we imagine God is, God is not. Whatever we imagine God is not, God is. God is beyond. God is greater than infinity and less than zero. So God is beyond comprehension. But there is an aspect of God, God the Creator, who I think is the basis of our universe. And it's that God that perhaps we can relate to and that our consciousness can somehow connect with.
Yeah, I think it's everything, I guess.
I think it's beyond everything, actually. I think that's the mystery, that God is beyond everything. He's more than everything, and simultaneously is less than everything. God is no thing. He is not even zero, and yet he is infinite.
Yes.
That's the mystery.
Well, I'm also curious about something else. A lot of the people that have come to writing books like this or come to an understanding like you've come to have, a lot of them have had to go through what we call dark nights of the soul
mm-hmm.
before they could get to this point. Did that happen to you?
Well, I still have that sometimes because I find life rather frustrating at times because, you know, especially when having written a book like this, you know, I think when some of the things I say are important, and yet
mm-hmm.
what do you find on television and radio, and what do you find among the bestsellers? You find trivia. The world today is full of trivia. The world is becoming more trivialized by the day. And so it's frustrating to me to see that the interest of people is directed towards things that are worthless, that are not important, that they're insignificant, and away from things that really are deeply significant, such as, is there a God? Is there a purpose for my life?
Mm-hmm.
What is my nature? Why do people not care about that, but rather want to find out what happened to Paris Hilton when she went to jail?
Right,
so foolish.
I agree. Do you find that you become more reclusive as time goes by?
I guess I have a bit, yeah. Yes, I have
yeah,
a bit.
Yeah, me too. I feel I can't deal with all the nonsense out in the world anymore.
Yeah, I tend to go less to the parties or entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to have less fun doing that than I used to when I was younger, so I think some of that is a bit of world weariness and sort of, in German they call it Affenspiel, which is sort of monkey play.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of get tired of the monkey play.
Yeah, I agree. Most of us have experienced something like that, that's happened to them.
Yeah.
They become a lot more reclusive.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to ask you about, we got just a couple more minutes, is going back to the dark night of the soul, another thing that most of these scientists, as well as the mystics, has observed is that they usually come in swings, and like, if you have a dark night of the soul, Fred Allen Wolf said to me one time, thank God, because you know that because of maybe polarity, who knows, that around the corner there's going to be bliss.
Mm.
And then it's going to swing back and you're going to have a misery again. And then it's going to swing. To whatever degree you experience the bliss, you're also going to have that same degree of misery. So you have to find the middle of the road to walk and not put so much charge into it to keep that from happening. Have you experienced anything like that in your life?
Well, I feel a little bit short of the bliss side, actually. I could use a little bit more bliss from time to time.
Do you practice living in the moment?
You know, probably I don't. I tend to get too future-oriented, at least according to my wife, who's very much in the present moment. She tells me I'm too oriented toward the future, too goal-oriented. That's what she says.
So, do you understand about living in the moment?
Probably not. That's probably why she complains about it.
Because I find that when I don't have the bliss that I want, or my people that study under me, I say, find something to do to distract you from whatever it is that you're going in the future or in the past. Get a toothbrush and clean the grout in your tile. You know, do something to force you to stay in this instant moment.
Mm-hmm.
It stops thought, you know, and it enables you to get into kind of that altered state of mind so that you can manifest that state that you want to be in. It happens to me all the time, and
mm-hmm.
it's amazing the things that come about when it does. So is there anything you want to say before we wind this up, because we're about out of time?
Well, just invite your listeners to get a hold of a copy of the book and see if it can help them, because I think that, you know, finding a purpose and something to believe in life is one of the most important things you can do, and you've got
well,
some good ideas.
Well, I tell you, I love it when one of you scientists that's you know, extremely respected in your field comes out and does something like this. It takes a lot of guts to do it, but it makes me so happy because I think that we're conditioned by science since kindergarten. And only when people like you come out and say this is the world going to listen. So I thank you for that.
Thank you.
So come back and be on the show again sometime. Maybe when I can read your book and get some more understanding about what you're saying. Because it's a deep book for somebody like me. But I hope you'll come back sometime. And I thank you for what you've done. And I thank you for being with me tonight.
Very good. Thank you very much. Good night.
This is Bill Tiller of Tiller.org. You're listening to BBSRadio.com. Don't forget to tune in to The Infinite Consciousness with Eva Herr every Sunday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time. Enjoy.